questions. And also, if you still have questions for the speakers, I think that's important. So where shall we start? Who would like to start?
We're going to be short, sharp, and shiny. We discussed a breadth of issues. I don't think we actually came out with any coherent ideas. Well, we kind of started on question two, then it got all very complex, and we sort of bifurcated in lots of different directions. Well, just starting from our own experiences, I'm undertaking some research in Cambodia, project management here. And we're talking about how we found that trying to discuss complex ideas with people who work on the ground, so to speak, and what's the policy application. I've been doing some work or interviews with people who work in the sexual health area in Cambodia. And for those who work for, I guess, the more robust NGOs, those that seem to be doing a good job, they say, well, look, sorry, we're already doing that. I mean, you've given me some clever language. It sounds all very nice. But in terms of working day to day, this is what we do. This is how we manage it. So what are you actually giving me? And I've been hard-pressed to answer that question. You've been saying the same thing in project management. Those projects that do well, and it's the same as the construction example that was given earlier, is that you deceive, you lie, you cheat, you work politically, however you wish to phrase it, in order to achieve various outcomes or sustain good outcomes. So in not wanting just to... you know, give people on the ground a bunch of new buzzwords that they have to learn and, you know, pills to swallow, and this is the language you need to use. I guess I'd throw the question back to Robert and Sammy and said, what are the conceptual tools? What is it that we can offer these people on the ground, you know, other than some clever words? I want to know what that next step is, and that's what I've been grappling with because I was a theorist originally and I'm trying to step into the real world, so to speak. The conversation then drifted also into economics, looking at our old sort of century-old theories of neoclassicist economics, which is sort of morphed into neoliberalism, all very much coming from a sort of Newtonian way of looking at the world. And you're saying a similar sort of thing again in economics. Those that do well at a smaller practical level are those who do the same thing. They fudge things in order to achieve certain outcomes. And I guess what you're saying you'd like to see happen is a similar thing, but on the theoretical sort of ground, a rigorous theoretical base for people who work in economics and are sort of accidentally coming across complexity. Yeah. Can they develop a rigorous theoretical base? I mean, there is some work out there, I know, but that's certainly what you're looking at. And the last place we ended up, so we didn't really answer any questions, is we're looking at that graph up there and saying that in many respects, all that's been done in terms of bailing out the banks is that we've avoided a tipping point effectively, is that we're in one basin of attraction, we're about to perhaps fall into another, and all that money that was thrown at the banks was to stop that next, perhaps that fall into catastrophe, to stop that fall into an alternative basin. And whether or not that was a good thing. Should we have allowed catastrophe to occur? Can you avoid catastrophe and develop new orders and new change? I don't want to say without pain, but without going into perhaps social collapse or social demise, in a nutshell. So that's pretty much where this table ended up. So we didn't really answer any of the questions. We just got some more questions. And I'll throw up to the next table.
That's great, thank you. Okay, who would like to go next?
Sort this mess out.
Okay, so I'm going to fight incoherence with incoherence. We were addressing which question to answer, and Ur here kind of made the point that it's actually the last question. It's impossible to prove that a complex approach kind of works because of issues related to complexity. So we decided to actually go for that particular question just as a red rag to a bull. But we focused more on sort of the ex-ante question. So if you're in front of a policymaker, what would you actually say? So I think most of the points that follow are kind of stem from that perspective. Eileen made the point that you first prove that the current system doesn't work, and Hank also made the first a similar point here. But also Hank made the point that you still have to sell it in front of the person. Samir made the point that you can, when you're discussing these things with people, one useful approach is to identify what they are doing already which resonates with complex systems, so that you can identify how they might relate to a complexity approach, which I thought was extremely useful. And he gave the examples of stakeholders and engagement, as you can use those words to kind of pinpoint actually those related to complexity theory. I made the point I've made to a few people that in my interpretation of complexity theory, when we compare it to systems approaches and linear thinking, is that complexity theory in a sense contains the old framework. If you constrain a complex system enough, you get the old framework, the old way of thinking. So in a sense, it's, to use an economist phrase, it's actually parative superior. Okay, so it's actually better in the old system. So in that sense, it ought to be better than the previous approach. And that's what it ought to be. Hank said that one of the values of complexity theory is that it allows us to ask smarter questions, which I thought was quite a useful way of putting it. So if you're trying to sell it to a policymaker, maybe they can identify the value of complex systems simply in the way that you're asking the questions of that policymaker. And Alexander used his experience in the field to make the point that he takes the pain process pleasure approach. So if he's talking to a policymaker, he first identifies where is it painful for that person. The process aspect is that, tell me if I'm misinterpreting this, but you're trying to name the beast. You're kind of trying to identify what the problem is, where the pain, why the pain is actually coming, why it's coming to fruition. And then the pleasure aspect is gaining the permission to try and solve, to the extent possible, that fundamental problem. Is that represent?
More or less, on the pain, identify failures in the current system. The process, name the beast, also identifying, as Samir said, what is it they're already doing that they don't realize is complexity-based? So you reinforce what they're doing correct, or at least understand. And then on pleasure, it's identify where you can create enabling environments where complexity experiments can happen that you can point to and say, now, if we expanded this on a scalability, you could see where this might benefit the community as a whole, whether that community is a town or a country.
Okay, thank you. And the final thing we discussed, which was kind of both a pleasurable and a painful kind of discussion, was about measurability and quantification. Uwe made the point that it's important to quantify. What if you're trying to prove something works, you need to basically not just talk about it and say it's wonderful, but also actually to demonstrate it quantitatively if you can. And then on the other side of the spectrum, I made the point, and I think Eileen was made a similar point, that there are things that you can't quantify, and there are situations in which quantification does work, and there are situations in which quantification doesn't work. So hopefully I've represented that kind of discussion to a degree, and that's it.
Well done,
Greg.
You've
got the longer. I'm
going to think most of you can see right at the bottom there, but we'll try and transcribe those.
So by a quantification approach, we've done better.
My first thought was that the last group managed to get through a lot more than we did. We basically discussed, as I understood it, you know, problems to this, which was, for example, if we were dealing with a departmental elite, a lot of the norms of departmental elites are based on substantial size and sort of budget. So in other words, how would you, you know, get a departmental elite who's focused on size and budget to shift a position towards any sort of complexity thinking, when how would it affect those things? We didn't answer it, but we raised the issue. The other thing was how to get different departments coordinating with each other, and this was linked to incentive sharing and knowledge sharing, if I'm correct. And then, and a question there was, well, how do you get sort of sharing and learning? I guess learning was part of that. Sharing and learning across, where is the sharing and the learning going to occur? the motivation for any sort of sharing. Departments often defend their territory, are often loath to get involved with other actors in a sort of self-focused way. Could complexity do something to sort of break down that motivational limitations? This was linked into a brief discussion about strategic partnerships at a local level, and how at a local level these seem, although obviously having mixed results, there seems to be a degree of at least localized sharing, strategic partnerships, that goes beyond what seems to occur at an upper level, at least in the UK context. There was a brief discussion on collaborative budgets. If you had budgets that encouraged departments to cooperate with each other, that sort of forced them to, in terms of saying, "Well, here's these projects, etc." That would be part of getting them, in a sense, to do that. And then it was linked to that general concept. Well, how do you operate differently? We didn't really. Five more minutes, we would have sorted it out. But Eve said no, so I said okay. But that's as far as we got. Does anybody else want to add to that? I'm sorry. I hope I kind of got most of the bits.
Do you want 5 more minutes?
No. Eve said no, so we're done.
Okay. May I suggest then that you pick up some of the questions, particularly on the tools and methods. If you would like to just give us one or two of the ones you discuss in the book, I think that would be really useful.
All right.
And then pick in on comment or any questions on anything else. Yes.
Okay.
Well, so
yeah. Okay. I mean, the one thing I guess what strikes me and is the one that's the, I mean, if we do the very very quickly, I'll pull it up here. It links to. I guess there were two things occurred to me. Oh, you want me to grab that? Two things that quickly occurred to me was on the question of, well, how do we make something out of this? What can we show? And on the one thing you've got, I got to go back to, well, you've got to read the book. I mean, in essence, there's the concepts and tools that are there that are hopefully useful. But in a larger sense, I would argue, the one thing I always sort of fall back on is the one thing that I do think complexity does, it allows you to scrape away, if you like, the scientific veneer of, the power relations all stay the same. I mean, there's powerful people here and less powerful people there. But it allows you to scrape away the scientific justification for actors who are claiming, I am doing this on an evidence base, and therefore it must be good. This is evidence-based strategy. This is, perfectly rational. In essence, complexity says, well, okay, that might fit for certain problems in certain areas. But for these other areas, that's not only useless, but it's maldirected, it's maladaptive. And so, to me, yes, it doesn't radically alter the power relationships, but it does, if you like, scrape away the linear paradigm scientific justification, saying, well, actually, science doesn't support that. That's a type of science from the 17th, 18th, up to 19th century, did amazing things and is perfectly relevant to these things, but less so to others. And to me, it gets back to, again, it's not ours, Ralph Stacey's work years ago, we'll just use his, and all he said is fantastically simple. He just says, he basically just said, well, if you have a zone, if you had a scale, high agreement, low agreement, and then you had another scale of certainty, high certainty of whatever your policy is, or low certainty of whatever your policy outcomes are. He just says, well, of which we all know, these decisions are all over the place. He just said, basically, if you were looking at the high agreement, everybody agrees, they know what the problem is. You can take whatever policy area you like. You can take a health policy. I did some work on diabetes. Bang. High agreement. We should do something for the patients. Type 2 diabetes tend to need insulin and the regimes around it. Great, we can have very high evidence-based technical solutions. We can lay out parameters to how to deal with them. Those parameters can be put in textbooks. They can be memorized by students. No problem, we can deal with that. Bang. Interesting thing, you immediately say, well, okay, what happens if we start having uncertainties? So we move into where our experts disagree. What is the exact, let's say you have, there's different types of diabetes, there's different types of treatment for them. Different experts can disagree on them. So here you begin to say, okay, evidence plays a role, evidence plays there, but judgment starts coming to play, expert judgment between between the people who are studying this area, making the best they can, bang. So in other words, you move from this purely orderly linear decision making, you know, techno-rational, to judgmental. Your experts can disagree, and reasonable strategies can be debated between them. You also then move into, you have high agreement, patient agrees with the doctor, yes, make me better. Now, how do I shift my life to integrate this chronic condition? Well, the doctor may say, right, you eat this, 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 you exercise this, 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 you control this, this, this. The patient says, whoa, wait a minute here. I have a disagreement with you. And this might be a young adult linked in with a family. So you've got, the family might be, let's say, maladaptive. Let's say mom's an alcoholic. Let's say there's a father who's abusive. All of a sudden, lots of political disagreements here, if you like. So bang, your evidence base, yes, it can feed into it. Fundamentally, you're making political decisions. These are political. The best you can search for is consensus. Move over here, and you're into the nasty zone. This is the closest you could get here. I would imagine having what's called brittle diabetes. It means it fluctuates and interacts with insulin in an erratic fashion. So the insulin doesn't stabilize it as it should. And imagine if you were coming with the maladaptive family or what have you, economic deprivation, dealing with drug addiction, dealing with socially abusive behavior. What do you do? Classic case there, talking to one social care worker who was talking to a new mother who was smoking, went to the smoking mother, said, gee, I'm here from the health services, and I'm here to tell you that you should stop your smoking. It's bad for you, bad for your baby. To which the mother replies, well, the smoking helps to calm my nerves, and the baby's driving me crazy, so if I stop smoking, I'll throw my baby out the window. How do you respond? The best you can possibly do in this zone is experienced intuition, because class, as I think it was Prigozhin's famous quote, or it might have been Kaufman, I can't remember, said it's like walking through a maze where the walls change with every step you take. So at best, you're talking intuition here. The idea of collecting evidence or making evidence-based decisions is just silly. Through here is this whole zone, and here we have, chronic conditions, that's a mixture that actors are doing all the time. Normal sort of decision-making, it's a combination, might be consensual strategy, linking with experts coming together, linking with, and here, in this particular slide here, we've got chronic prevention approach, integration cooperation, as we say, more social than health here, primary community care, complexity zone. And in essence, for us, the whole point of this tool was to come in to say, bang, the key isn't to say, aha, the closer we get here, the better our decisions are going to be, the better our organizational structure. The real skill is to say, where are we on here? And if we're here, or here, or here, let's choose some appropriate strategies and decision-making to get us here. Because throwing more money at these problems to get the evidence isn't going to push them over here. You could double the data. You could quadruple the data. It's the exact same. You're back to the communist planning problem. You could take every element of, pricing data from the entire economy, and you still wouldn't be able to predict the price of toothpaste the following week. You're the exact same thing. And what's fascinating, and I always do this with my students, I say, you're trying to get the students to understand. It's a great way to embarrass the students. How many children are you going to have? What's your partner's, the color of their eyes when you settle down with them? What's it going to be? When are you going to get married? And of course, all the students. But they will. I can predict aggregate. You can give aggregates immediately. Voomph. Here, you will have 1.8, and you'll get married in 6 months' time, and you're likely to have blue eyes. Your partner will have blue eyes. No problem. You can do that straight away. And yet, all these students walking through that, they manage to, they don't know, they don't want to know, but they'll manage to walk through that healthily, normally, adaptively, no problemo. And so to me, the real power of this is to sort of recognize that. And once you recognize it, a whole variety of opportunities, a whole variety of thinking comes out. Now, that's a difficult, there's obviously when you're confronting those orderly things, bang, show me the evidence, show me the thing. And you get back to the tricky questions that were raised here. exactly the right animal raised at our table. How do you confront a really hardcore? Show me the evidence. To me, that was a tactic that we were talking about earlier. Can you create the qualitative evidence by working with actors to create a sense of, okay, actually, we think this is kind of interesting. We think to open that space where you get that, if you like, the buildup in converts, believers, who in a sense say, you know, this is kind of interesting, we'll do it. And then could you actually then allow the spillover from that to say, well, actually in local community X or in policy Y, we did this. And it seemed to possibly eventually lead to the quantitative indicators that could show, if you like, a winning, the winning situation that actually appeals to that earlier framework. Problem is, actors in the earlier framework immediately just say, well, we need it now. In essence, you've got to give the system time to run, and you can never guarantee. No way can you guarantee in 6 months' time, bang, problems. These problems will be solved. You can't guarantee it. They might get there. But I would argue, in a sense, you've got to make the qualitative argument first, because the quantitative stuff, you can't guarantee that's going to show up later. Sorry, I mean, I don't know.
What you want to say, trust me, I'm a doctor.
You want to say, trust me, I think I have a better way of doing things, but you and I have to walk through that way together. And you and I have to work on that, because I'm not going to be able to say, step here and I guarantee your strategies will improve by 20%. I can say, step here, and I think your strategies will eventually improve by 20%, but you have to walk with me, because I'm not the computer program that's going to tell you, I'm not the computer model that's going to tell you that's the way we go. And, whatever happens, just ignore it, because we're heading that way. And that's the end state planning that Sammy was mentioning earlier.
Sammy, did you have a comment?
May I just augment what Robert was saying, and then...
I think you meant improve, didn't you?
Improve? No. Impossible. I mean, we're all used to this area that Robert mentioned about sort of evidence-based work, and we're all aware of that, and it's easy, and you think that we are reinventing the wheel when we are talking about that bit. But actually, even in this area, we do actually work in complexity tools now. So may I just, could you modernization agency thing?
The waterfall?
No, that one. Right. I mean, that is not something that we invented, right? It's actually a process which they use in the complexity zone. And they say, look, what you've got to do is to define what are we trying to achieve. And then go down here, and you see something here. And most of you who have worked in the public and private sector have done it for years and years and years. And we used to do something called SWOT system. I don't know.
Yes.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
Well, that's complexity, damn it. So this business of proving to people and trying to convert people and is really passé. It's not necessary anymore, because you could say to them, by the way, SWOT system is very, very good. And act, plan, do, study, and then double back on that in a circular method is quite good. And every now and then, go back and look at whether what you decided at the beginning you wanted to do still is meaningful, and double back on that. Well, that's complexity. And yet, it was produced by somebody, I don't remember whether...
It's 96, I think it is, yeah.
The date, sorry?
It was 1996, I recall.
Something, as early as that. And so the point I'm making really is that it is not something that is either revolutionary or it's not being done. Actually, the processes are all there and it's being used day in, day out by companies. I'll just give you one final example, please. We had in the Department of Health a program called the Productive Ward. Are you a medical doctor?
No, but I work with... Yeah.
Yeah. productive wars. And they said, the Department of Health said, you know what you need to do with a ward in a hospital? You need to get all the staff working in the ward and to sit together and say, how could we improve things? And they came to the Royal Liverpool Hospital in Liverpool, and they said, are any volunteers? Yes. Ward 17 decided they will do it. And the sisters and the ward and the nurses and all the elderly staff, whatever it is, sat together and said, well, you know, we could tidy up the storage area here. They did something quite revolutionary. You know, the trolley that brings the food to the patients. Now, would you believe they brought all the meals in a disorganized way? And therefore, the nurse used to come and say, right, patient number 6, that's yours. Now, patient number 14, that's yours. 12, that's yours. And they decided, no, they're going to tell the kitchen to put the meals in the order of the beds in the ward. To cut a long story short, that hospital produced an incredible improvement in productivity, in time that nurses could spend talking to patients and working with patients. And you know what? No other ward in the hospital did it. It happened. And they didn't realize they were actually dealing with complex systems. So, I mean, please, although we say, how do you prove it works and converting people to it, actually, what we really need to do is to say to people, you're doing it.
Yes.
One of the really powerful things for me in that previous diagram on the bottom left corner is to make the challenge when measurement and targets are actually being used to pretend we're in the bottom left corner.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's really powerful for me, because you can then get people to ask themselves that question.
Yes.
See these targets and everything else, measurement we're using, are we pretending to be in the bottom left? Or I'm doing something meaningful.
That's that I would argue is the scraping away of that veneer.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that to me is the real power.
And that's why you can't say targets are wrong, because I think the point you're making to us, targets are right in the right place.
Exactly.
Yes. Thank you very much. Okay.
Well,
quick.
Sir, I was
yes.
just going to say, like you said, you just need to tell people they're doing it. But why should people care?
Yeah.
Well, sorry.
Why should people care that they're doing something that's a big complexity? I mean, I don't think out in the real world people care about the labels or the tools and techniques they're particularly applying.
Yeah.
And actually, that's a big turn off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's something that every time, in every situation, and what you are really saying to it is, please, before you take any action whatsoever, will you decide which zone are you in? Because unless you know which zone you are in, you can't decide what solution. You know, I work at the moment, I'm working with a group dealing with the Nile Delta, you know, with the World Bank. The Mediterranean is going up, Nile Delta is going down, and there are problems. And our group of very, very expert people have decided that what we need is modeling. And it astonished me. And we had a row about it, by the way, a few weeks ago, because of course I was saying, hang on a minute, what are we trying to do? Which bit of the zone are we in? What sort? Forget about the solution. I don't even know where we are. So all we are really saying in this book is, please realize that everything you deal with is in that range, and define where you are in that range, and then by all means decide on it. So you decide on targets, measurements. I deal with sustainable development, and we have a lot of work on sustainable development indicators. I don't know whether anybody deals with them. And Britain has 66 sustainable development indicators. You know, maybe you have come across them. And the British government is proud to produce how much progress is made on the 66 and so on. And they're all within the measurable zone in that corner. They don't have anything anywhere else.
The Army have a good phrase for this, though. No, the Army have an excellent phrase for this, which is hit the target, miss the point.
I think that is the perfect way to. I like that very much, actually. I think that just captures it. That's been a really good afternoon, I think. I don't think we've answered many questions, but that is not the point. I think the point is to keep exploring and pushing at these boundaries, because that's the only way in which we can actually understand our world as a complex world, and then how do we actually address it and approach it. I think that is the important element. Please join me to thank both our speakers, because I think they really have done a brilliant job. And hope to see you on the 1st and 8th. Yes.
Could I ask everyone to please thank Eve for organizing not only this minor event, but the string of other events.
Yes.